Three Pius X teachers have just returned from an educational tour of historic sites in Poland and Israel as part of the Holocaust Educators Network, a program sponsored by the Memorial Library in New York City. They are sharing their knowledge today and their experiences there. Katie Elsner is here, Tom Seib is here, and Jane Keneally, all from Pius. Thank you, Katie,
pleasure.
Tom, and Jane
for
coming
for
in and
us.
Taking time. You just got back on April 4th?
Yes.
Right.
Late in the evening on April 4th.
So you unpack and come into a radio station and talk about
exactly.
it. Exactly. Well, that's good. The timing is good because your memories are fresh. Explain how, of the 14 people that went, three from Pius. How did that happen, Tom?
Well, we got involved in this program in 2007 and 2008 through the Nebraska Writing Project and the University of Nebraska. They were looking, the Memorial Library, which is located in New York City, it was looking for teachers from rural areas to represent the Holocaust and teach other teachers how to teach the Holocaust more effectively, I guess is a good way to put it. And we, Katie and Jane, initially applied in 2007 and were accepted to go to New York City for some training in that summer. And I went in 2008, and that was our initial involvement in the program. There have been about 100 teachers now since 2007 have been trained by the Holocaust Educators Network. And then in 2010, that group of teachers was asked to submit application for a more, I guess you'd call it a more intense program to take what we had learned back to our states and began to train other teachers in how to teach the Holocaust on a more, I guess, a more bigger,
intimate?
A bit, well, not so much that, but just in a bigger way.
Hmm.
A more intense way.
All right, let me interrupt you, Tom. How is that trip going to make that happen, Katie?
We have learned so much, and what they provided to us very generously, the Memorial Library, is a life-changing experience where I feel like I've taught Holocaust studies for 22 years, and I feel that I learned so much. And until you really go to those places and experience it, it just deepens our knowledge and what we can take back to the classroom and what we can take back to classroom teachers.
None of you had ever been there before.
No, this was a first trip for all of us.
Jane, how is that going to make you a better teacher?
Well, it's going to absolutely change the way I look at the news that we receive about Tel Aviv and Israel, because I've been there and I've met people and I've made friends. We were so fortunate that we were able to talk to teachers from Israel, and now we are no longer strangers to those people. And now we understand their story from their individual perspective. And so that changes me, because I always have to keep in mind that my students are individuals. I can't make assumptions. I can't make generalities about them. And I remind myself now that I can't make grand sweeping gestures and generalizations about the country of Israel now that I've met the individual people and have learned their stories.
Tom, how's that going to change you as a teacher in your classroom?
Well, I think it'll, again, just as Jane and Katie said, it gives us a breadth of knowledge that we can't get out of watching movies and reading books. When you get to actually meet the people who've been involved in the foundation of the State of Israel, for example, there's no way you can get that knowledge any other way. Earlier this week, we had a meeting with the mayor of Tel Aviv, who was born in 1944 and went through the foundation of the State of Israel. You're not going to get that kind of experience in any other way. Things like that were part of this trip. We were able to visit with members of the Knesset and things like that. Just things like that you just can't get in any other way.
All right, tell us all where you went. Give us an itinerary, Katie.
We started out in Poland, and we flew into Warsaw, and of course toured Warsaw, the site of where the Warsaw Ghetto was, cemeteries. We traveled to Lublin and Majdanek, concentration camp, which is, of course, quite powerful. We traveled to Krakow and Auschwitz-Birkenau. very emotional, very, very emotional day.
I'm going to jump in on you here, Katie. One of the things that happened at Birkenau that was just an incredible life changer is, as Katie said, we'd already been to one death camp, and we were in a second one. And Birkenau, the territory that it covers is just enormous. You literally cannot see the end of the camp. And we were becoming very, very, very despondent. It was so depressing to think of the number of lives that were lost there. And as we were walking along, we kind of, you know, we're walking in a big group, and we came upon another big group, and they were all carrying Israeli flags. And our guide, who spoke 15 different languages, Jacob, introduced us to them. And as Tom said, they were part of the Parliamentary Guard from Israel. And when they learned what our mission was, that we were Holocaust educators from all across the United States, they started hugging us and cheering and singing and gave us their Israeli flags that they were carrying. And they just expressed over and over how appreciative they were of what we were doing as educators in America so that people would know about the Holocaust and hopefully change the way they see Israel.
Now, I'm curious. Did they say, when you go back, please mention or please focus on or please teach that? Did they come up with anything? Be sure
no,
to convey
no. they
that.
They did not have an
fill
agenda.
In the blank.
They had no agenda
okay.
whatsoever. They were just very appreciative
okay.
that we were remembering them. It was a very poignant moment, and it really gave us hope.
Concentration camps are very difficult to explain.
Oh, yes.
I toured Dachau, and to see the bunks and the furnaces and the kilns, and it's life-changing. It truly is.
And I think one of the things that struck all of us at Birkenau especially, they have a room, and anybody who's been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. has seen a little piece of this, but they had a room with shoes, 80,000 pairs of shoes, hair of the victims, just unbelievable how much. And then there's a special one that had the shoes of little children, babies and little children, and you couldn't help but be emotionally touched by that. It just was more than you could almost handle to see that and realize what had gone on in that place.
And to realize that this was an industrialized effort, that the people who were perpetuating these crimes were profiting from them, because all of those, that plunder went back into Germany and other countries and was sold, you know. People who were shipped to some of the death camps actually bought tickets to go on the trains because of the propaganda that they had been handed and that they thought that they were being relocated. They bought new apartments. They bought these train tickets. And so the duplicity that went into the Holocaust and then the gain, the profit from human lives was just devastating to see.
Did you know that, Jane?
No, that was a completely new
detail
for
me. Will that be taught? Will you include that as a teacher?
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Especially, I think, just understanding that this was an industrialized effort. This was not a genocide that was perpetuated in 100 days. We're coming up on the anniversary of the Rwandan genocide here. And, you know, that was something that was very passionate and swept the nation on an emotional level. But this was cold. This was calculated. This was an industrialized scheme to eliminate a certain group of people. Other people were involved, too. But it was an attempt to completely eradicate all Jews from the world.
And it was such initially a clumsy effort that
right.
was refined and processed to become such have its own momentum and try mm-hmm. to make it as efficient as possible.
That was the other thing that really struck you. We went to several places where they showed us the railroad system that was put together to pull this off is just unbelievable. The amount of, like you were saying, the amount of planning and strategy that had to go into just getting these people to the camps showed how unbelievably industrialized and obsessed they were mm-hmm. with pulling this off.
And the fact that it really pulled away from the actual war effort. You know, had Hitler put his efforts a little bit more militarily focused. That's not a good word, but anyway, if he had been a little bit more focused on actually winning the war than eliminating the Jews, he might have made greater strides into Russia, the Soviet Union. And Katie teaches a lot about the Wannsee Conference and where this planning for the final solution was. So,
what did you learn on that subject, Katie?
Oh, I learned so much about just everything. I have to tell you, Jacob, our guide, was a historian, and our motto was, who needs Google? Just ask Jacob. He answered all our questions about the system. I learned how the system worked, as Jane said, about I didn't know that some Jews had to buy tickets, one-way tickets. Just all kinds of details. We were taking notes constantly. We all had our notebooks out. But something that's very fascinating was we were privileged to travel with a survivor. Asia was a survivor. She grew up in Poland, of course, shared her story with us. And when we moved on to Lodz in the Lodz ghetto, she had lived there after the war. And we ended up looking for her house and finding where she lived after the war for a few years. And it was really exciting. We had actually a camera crew with us, and we're filming her, and everybody's looking at us. And we go back in kind of an alley, and she says, yes, that was my window up there. And they went in the house. No one was at her particular apartment, but she got to go into another apartment in the house. And it was just, she's a remarkable woman. After the war, she moved to Israel and was in the military. And so was her husband. And so she helped to found Israel. And just a lovely, wonderful woman that we were very, very privileged to get to know, and she is now our friend. She has invited us all back to Israel to visit her, and she's just wonderful. So
that she was hidden by a Catholic family, and it was very interesting because when the war ended, she said, I didn't realize that there were any Jews left. So can you imagine being a part of a community and being hidden away and your identity stripped from you and your religion stripped from you, and then emerging from this thinking that you're the only one left? And so she says that Israel is the only place where she feels free.
We have more of this interesting conversation coming up for you here. Tom Seib is here, Jane Keneally is here, and so is Katie Elsner, teachers at Lincoln Pius. They've just returned from an educational tour of historic sites in Poland and Israel as part of the Holocaust Educators Network. And we'll keep talking about it when Lincoln Live continues. Lincoln Live today is with Katie Elsner, Tom Seib, and Jane Keneally from Pius High School, educators who went along on tour to historical sites in Poland and Israel as part of the Holocaust Educators Network. They just returned from their experience. I'm curious, and I'll direct this one towards you, Katie. How is the Holocaust evident in Poland? Tell us how Poland has reacted to it.
It's very interesting. You know, Poland has a harsh history, largely due to geographically where it's located. But we see that they have made great attempts to memorialize the victims. In the cemeteries, we saw memorials and statues, and of course the camps and the ghettos. The Warsaw Ghetto is no longer there, but there you can walk the path, and there are memorials along the path of events there. We drove into Lodz, which is a place of where there was a huge ghetto, and it was very disturbing because anti-Semitism was evident. They have graffiti all over the city, and the graffiti someone, whoever is doing this, puts a Star of David up, and then they put the rival soccer team's name over the Star of David. It's calling, we hate you, so it's calling them, the rival soccer team, a Jew. And what the city does is they, almost every night, they paint over the graffiti, and the next day it's there. And it was everywhere. We saw several of these. So there are not many Jews left in Poland, but the anti-Semitism is still there. And we think of ourselves as so enlightened in the 21st century, and this was just really very upsetting to all of us, and it just demonstrates why this education is so vital today.
Katie's always teaching about the power of words in her classroom, and for us this was the power of symbols, and wondering if whoever is drawing this graffiti even is aware of the incredible damage that they're causing. But it definitely was a symbol of hate, and it was, as Katie said, all over the city. So I think we need to consider that when we're talking about the power of words. We need to talk about the power of symbols as well.
As I was riding a train through Germany, I would just close my eyes to make it cloudy and use my imagination, I could almost put myself back to that time and imagine what it was like living under this strict control. Did you find yourself at times, whether it was the weather or whether it was the people you talked to or were you around, find yourself almost being there?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Every time I saw a train or train tracks, I thought of the history of the trains in Poland. And even the history of the Soviets occupying for so long and the ugly buildings. And Jacob, our guide, had us meet with some Polish teachers, and they were laughing. And he said, even 15 years ago, they wouldn't have been laughing. It was such a dreary place. So they're trying to come out of this, but it's difficult.
At one point, a group of teachers took a cable car up to the top of Masada when we were in Israel. Katie, Tom, and I actually hiked it. I have to throw that out real fast. But when they were crammed onto this cable car, there was about 80 of them in there. And they said you couldn't help but turn to the left and to the right and whisper to each other, do you suppose this is what it was like on the cattle cars? So everywhere we went, every crowd we were in the line at the customs office trying to get back into the States, and it permeates your thinking now. This is the kind of lines that people had to try and stand in every single day just to get a visa to get out before the curtain really fell in the 40s.
Tom, recall a person that you encountered that made an impression on you.
I think the person that probably made the biggest impression on all of us was Asya, their survivor, I suppose, and we've told her story already too. But I think, especially in Israel, I think the young people, the students in Israel, made a big impression on all of us. We saw a lot of, I'd say in Poland too, the Israeli young people are, when they go into the military, everybody in Israel, every student in Israel is required to join the military, men and women. When they hit the age of 18, they have to spend 3 years of their life in service to the country and in the military. As a part of that service, they are required to go visit Auschwitz-Birkenau, one of the camps, as a part of that, so they understand why they are serving. Israel is surrounded by enemies. There are no friends of Israel anywhere around them. And they want those students to understand why they're serving their country for 3 years, and they go in large groups, and we saw them constantly. We saw these large groups of Israeli young 18, 19, 20-year-olds visiting the camps when we were there, and it was unbelievable. 200 to 300 of them at a time at these camps, and they're trying to get them to understand this is why you are serving your country, is because we don't want this to ever happen again, but we also want you to understand why we have to protect our country.
Now, I'm curious, you all have 18-year-olds in your classes. Compare an 18-year-old Israeli with an 18-year-old American. And one of the first things I think of as an American would be, not flippant, but maybe less devoted, or maybe even rebellious against going into the military if they were forced to. Compare an Israeli 18-year-old to some of the 18-year-olds that you're used to seeing.
I asked the question when we met the mayor of Tel Aviv, at what age or grade do you start teaching Holocaust studies? And he said, I can't really answer that. Later on, the teachers told us in kindergarten, but he said it's everywhere. It's everywhere for these, when these children are small, it's here. It's very present. It's all around them. So I think they grow up with this real respect, and I felt a great deal of patriotism in Israel.
Absolutely.
And they love their country, and they just know they need a place where they can feel safe and secure. We would see soldiers everywhere we went, and, you know, of course, at our age, they all look like they're about 12, mm-hmm. But they certainly seemed to know what they were doing, and they certainly had a purpose. We saw a beautiful ceremony in the Warsaw Ghetto when we were there. We just happened upon it. These Israeli soldiers were all there, and they were honoring the victims from the ghetto, and it was just beautiful and solemn and really something to see.
I think the only way I can compare it is in our great state of Nebraska, our kids know that they're proud to be Cornhuskers, but you can't say when they learned that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very odd comparison, I'm sure, but these Israeli children know from the most immediate age that they are Israeli and that they know that they are a nation founded on survivors, and they're very proud of that, and that they should be. The country is incredible. What they've done in 70 years is mind-boggling.
And I think what struck me a lot, too, was constantly seeing large groups of, again, 18-year-olds comparing to our students carrying AK-47s around all over the streets of Israel. They all have them. Every soldier has an AK-47 with them everywhere they go. And to think in the United States we would think that was unbelievably terrible, but every one of them has a gun with them everywhere they go, and they're 18 years old, and it's kind of mind-boggling to think that.
Jane, someone that impressed you?
Brother Olivier was a monk that we met, and he was a Benedictine, I believe. Is that
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah,
I think that's
Benedictine.
Correct.
And we've had a lot of experience with Benedictines at our schools, so we know and love them. But Brother Olivier was incredible because he had served in the French army, and he had moved to Israel and had been there for over 30 years and had reached out to Israeli soldiers. And he and a special friend, Israeli soldier, had started a singing group. And again, it was just an example of reaching out to other people and seeing them as friends and making a connecting bridge between two people that might not at first be enemies, this Catholic monk and this Jewish Israeli. And then he told stories about his ordination and how people from his motorcycle club came. He's part of a Harley-Davidson motorcycle club there in Israel, and showing us all the pictures. And so just realizing that there's good in all humans, and that's what we were meant to do, is to be good to one another and to reach out to one another and to speak to those who are different from us and appreciate them for all the good that they can do, rather than being afraid of them and seeing them as the other and creating walls between us instead of bridges.
Did any of you learn that what you have been teaching, or any elements of what you have been teaching, may have not been entirely correct? And because of this immersion, you've learned how to teach it better?
I certainly have learned how to teach it better. I do quite a bit with the Luj Ghetto, and I learned whole lot by going there and by learning from Jacob, our guide. And I didn't think I taught anything wrong, but certainly I'm working on it, and I will change some things. And it's enhanced and enriched mm-hmm. my it will enhance and enrich my curriculum.
And I think because of the fact that we've been involved in this program now for almost 5 years, I don't think we realized we were doing anything wrong. I think it was more of, as Katie said, adding more to our repertoire of what we can teach and how to teach it more effectively.
And you have to realize that we had great training from the Memorial
exactly.
Library. When Katie and I went back in 2007, Tom went back in 2008. We've also worked with the Anti-Defamation League. I went through the Bearing Witness program. They're going to offer a Bearing Witness program in Omaha this summer if anyone's interested in attending that. We've had some great partners, and we've always made sure that when we're teaching the students, we are looking at ways to expose them to this tragedy without traumatizing them, which is a really important part of the education. In America, in my personal opinion, and I think the ADL would back me up on this, there are some things that you shouldn't expose the children to. The expression is you can take them up to the gates of Auschwitz, but don't open those gates. And so it's really important to be aware of that and not launch into kind of the necropornography of what some people relish when they're studying the Holocaust.
Tom, there's not much school left. How do you keep your mental momentum going through the summer?
It's That's a good question. I think our focus right now is going to be on our summer seminar, which will be for teachers over throughout the state of Nebraska, which we're working on now. I think most of us have probably completed most of our Holocaust studies for this year anyway in our classrooms, so we're kind of focusing on putting that together now. But going back to school next week will be difficult. There's no doubt about that.
One of the things, though, that you find once you really become a Holocaust scholar is that everything you teach can come back to the Holocaust. The lessons that it shows us about good versus evil, knowing the other, knowing yourself, caring about your fellow humans, applies to absolutely everything you teach in an English class. It can be used in a math class. It can be used in an art and music. The vocal music teacher at Pius just did a fabulous spring show about the Holocaust. Our one-act director's play that I believe won districts this year was actually a Holocaust story. It's just important to remind our students, remind people around us that we always try and say never again, and we know that that doesn't quite happen. But we need to, rather than have answers, give possibilities, and that we need to teach our students that we want it to be never again. We've got to work towards that.
Asia, the survivor, got up one of our last nights and said to us something that was quite moving to all of us. She said that she loved us all, and we all gave her hope for never again. And that's our goal, just to make everyone feel the responsibility, every individual student we have, and to see the responsibility they have for kindness and goodness to other people, and to stop any injustice that they see.
I knew we'd run out of time. I knew there'd be more material than time, and it's come to that point. Thank you all very much. Katie, I appreciate it very much, and Jane, Tom, students are lucky to be in your classes.
Our pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us on Lincoln Live.